Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. And on this program, we deal with Russian history, politics, and philosophy from the point of view of Eurasianism, nationalism, monarchy, in the Orthodox senses of those words. Today, I wanted to start off by talking about someone who gets misunderstood quite a bit. I did a program on him back in, I guess it was 2010, on Martin Heidegger. And the oddity with him is that he was a sort of a national socialist, not quite a Hitlerian, but certainly a national socialist. And he's still a mainstream writer. I suppose part of that is simply because of the nature of what he did was good enough that he earns it no matter what. And he's been reinterpreted so as to cut out as much of that as humanly possible. And his national socialism was something that's justifiable, even from the mainstream point of view. He's very important to us for a few reasons. You know, he's important to us. He was important to Alexander Dugin. He was important to the right wing, so to speak, in general. And he is part of an older Russian tradition of seeing the reality as it is before it gets divided up into concepts and objects. An object, anything that we perceive and we take it as singular, you know, anything in front of us, the cat that's next to me, this is arbitrary. It's a creation of the will. There is no good reason, philosophically speaking, to remove one hunk of being from the whole and then give it a name. We do that because we're limited. We do that because we need these things. We find them of interest. Heidegger's primary, most essential criticism is that Western thinking, actually the entirety of Western thinking, after Heraclitus really, starting even with Plato, views the world as a collection of things. The theological problem here is that often God gets included as one thing among many. So you're asked to prove his existence as if he is one object among other objects, rather than the ground of objects. Can't really prove God's existence, since he is why there could be proof at all. He is why he is the ground of things rather than a thing. But to put it very simply, because we make these arbitrary divisions, and I think it's gotten worse as time has gone on, nominalism has completely destroyed the concept of being, even destroyed the concept of a thing. Everything is arbitrary. The nominalist idea, I have called it the ontology of death. I'm working on a book now for some time about the matter. The ontology of death means that nominalism is the ultimate separation of the spiritual realm from the material realm. In the Soviet Union, this was the arcane understanding of the sickle. The sickle is a very ancient symbol. It has certain positive elements, but it has negative elements. Michael Hoffman mentions that this is the scythe of Saturn. Saturn is associated with the metal lead to be completely material, impenetrable. And spiritual is always kept out. This leaden scythe removes our consciousness from any understanding of the world of forms. It's even deeper than that. But it certainly is not representative, even in a derivative sense, of the peasantry. The Soviet Union had no interest in the peasants. They did absolutely nothing to improve their lot. They slaughtered them in huge numbers as a matter of policy. especially since they're being bailed out by the West on a regular basis. They didn't really have to be rational in terms of their food production. So therefore, the sickle on the Soviet flag cannot refer to the peasantry. There was never a moment outside of the most crude propaganda that they believed that they were interested in the peasantry. The peasantry was their enemy from day one. The peasantry was a nationalist and traditionalist in a very intuitive sense, not an ideological sense, but an intuitive sense. They were foreign to ideology in the modern sense of the term. But for Heidegger, for people like S.L. Frank, Ferevsky, there's this whole tradition of personalism and intuitivism, I really should say. Being comes first. Being is that which exists prior to the human will arbitrarily selecting pieces of it and giving names to it. The intuitivist will say that being comes first. It's really the only thing that exists. We, of course, are a part of that. Even Heidegger will say that I'm not sure. I don't think Heidegger had ever read Frank before. I'm not even sure that Frank was in English or in German at that point, even though Frank was fluent in German. I'm not certain about that. But the concept is identical. The difference between the self and the external world is also completely fraudulent. There's no reason to believe, whether you're secular or religious, that the creation of the human person, the human soul, is something radically different from the creation of everything else, including other souls. That's also an act of will. But in Heidegger's mind, even when you take this arbitrary collection of things we call objects and actually believe is all there is, even that doesn't hold up the scrutiny. Because they're arbitrarily delineated from each other, they have a tendency to be fluid and to bleed into one another. This is not a terrible thing. It just continuously reminds us that what is there is this totality of things. Whenever we claim to know an object, we're also claiming to be able to abstract it from everything else around it. The modern looks at a concept of a tree, and you could picture that in your mind as a separate thing with that has a bark and branches and leaves. The problem is, yeah, that's a normal thing to do when you use that word. That's what you picture. And yet it's really a ridiculous concept because, you know, you can't separate it from the soil. You can't separate it from the entire ecosystem. You can't separate it from sunlight. You can't separate it from moisture, a million other things that go into its maintenance. Now, the difference is that those intuitivists who were Christians never thought that the creation of objects really was arbitrary. Or at least in the sense it's not conventional. It's part of natural law. The things that we have taken out of the whole and call them objects, things that we need, those aren't arbitrary. They may be conventional, but they're not arbitrary. They are part of natural law. We all need to be able to, you know, grow our own food and to be able to defend ourselves. These sorts of things as the very beginning of our language and how we understand the world. It's conventional in the sense that it's the details of these kind of things are you know, something that we invent and we need. But the concept, the deeper concept, is something that everyone needs and therefore isn't arbitrary. Heidegger is saying that these things are necessary. They're not foreign to human beings. They're conventional only in detail. We're born into a world that's already been divided up into these objects, whether it should be or not, including now individuals separated one from another. It is an act of will. It is an act really of almost of custom that one soul is taken, one person, one ego is taken as different from another. Even though we know that in every aspect of life, even the most mundane, we need a community of people. We need a community of people to argue the fact that we don't need a community of people. The Ayn Rand egocentric nonsense is refuted in the very fact that by explaining it, You need an entire civilization, an entire history, an entire community to be able to create that universe of meaning that makes sense out of these arguments. Heidegger uses the word Dasein. It's very famous. It refers to this context. We're born into this matrix of concepts and words that we didn't create. We're thrown into it. So this is not merely the cause of our will. I mean, we don't create this. We're born into it, and we have to negotiate it. Now, there are several ways that we can approach this. And this is why he gets called an existentialist. We can simply lose, and S.L. Frank says the exact same thing. We could lose ourselves in the brute givens, to conform, to do what we're told, to go along, to get along. And for a lot of people, that's really a happy life. They don't have to think. There's no pressure put on them. They don't make many enemies. They, especially in this society, are promoted. They're seen as non-threatening. They make friends very easily. You know, these are the kind of people, and every society needs these people. Not everyone can be this revolutionary. You know, that's one way to do it. The other way is equally pathological, and that is to be self-absorbed, to go into the ego and to live there as if this is a self-contained unity. This ends up being a pathological case where fantasy and concepts, you know, the mental illnesses like narcissism. You know, narcissism is a pathology only if your sense of self is in fact fantasy. It's not pathological if you're telling the truth about yourself. But when you lose yourself in ego as this other opposite pathological way of dealing with the sign, it ends up being a matter of fantasy. You create these glorious senses of self and mission, and it can become very dangerous. Either way is extremely unpleasant and pathological. Now, the problem is, it's hard for a lot of people when they read Heidegger for the first time to say, what is the payoff here? We can memorize all these concepts, and we could talk about the fullness of everything, how objects are arbitrary and conventional, how these are all acts of will, that there is a single whole, a massive whole of being that we couldn't possibly hope to cognize at any given moment. We can only take little chunks, pieces out of it. And how we react to this, how pathological it can be. Resisting it really is impossible because it's the very hard wiring of our thought. Losing ourselves in ego is impossible. To completely conform is outrageous, especially if society is irrational. But what is the ultimate payoff here? We're born into a world of object. When I say object, I'm not talking about external things. I'm talking about ideas. I'm talking about shared meanings. I'm talking about an entire world that's humanized. Now, here's the problem. Heidegger gave a speech in 1933, the self-assertion of the German university. This is one of his National Socialist speeches. And he says what he means by this Dasein. At its best, it is the shared meanings that only the nation can create. When I mean nation, I'm referring to this world, this context, this matrix of shared meanings, a language. And when I say language, I'm referring to something far broader than just, you know, syntax and vocabulary. An entire world of gestures and rituals and understandings where every little thing we do can be interpreted by someone else in a way that most people will understand. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to be healthy, but Heidegger is writing this at a time of extreme decay. He's writing this during the Weimar Republic. And he's noticing that this world of objects, this Dasein that we're thrown into, is completely unacceptable. But it does have its roots in the fact that the only kind of facticity that matters, the only time that this theory could ever matter at all socially, is when we understand this world of meanings, this assigned to be ethnic. We're not talking about states here, we're not talking about governments. We're talking about that was far more fundamental than that. We're talking about those things that every community has to have at its root. In order to have a world, in order to have this pre-created universe of meaning that we're all born into, that we didn't make, you have to have one language in the broad sense. You have to have a general fundamental sense of moral unity. You can't have a debate with someone unless you agree on the fundamentals. You have a level of agreement, and then above that, you may have a debate as to how to reach a certain good that you all agree on. You can't have civic association. You can't have a debate. You can't have a discussion unless the fundamental issues have already been solved. You can't debate fundamental issues because there's no ground of agreement. Not even speaking the same language in that case. Debate implies, and it always has implied, a social, ethnic, generally religious, and moral unity among people. That's the foundation. That's the foundation that keeps you from debating, but killing each other. You have the shared world that you live in. That's why you want to debate in the first place rather than just stab the guy. Now, 2016, United States, that's gone. Many of my listeners know what I mean when I say that we don't speak the same language as the common American. We don't live in the same world. Their world is so pathological, whether it be utter conformity or this fantasy world sunk into the ego. And a lot of that, there's no judgment here. Conformity and egocentrism, these can be the result of abuse. They can be the result of deep alienation, of the shock and the extreme unnaturalness, inorganic nature of modern America or modern life in general. So I'm not saying that these people are stupid or evil. Some of them are. Now, being stupid is so easy. You know, I envy these people sometimes. But now they're doing it often as a reaction to what's going on around them. It's a way to protect themselves. And in that case, you know, Das Man is this inauthentic way where we simply accept everything as it is so as to have an easy life. We don't ask too many questions because it's so much easier to do that. We will hide. We will claim that, you know, our actions and our thoughts, these are determined by others. It's not really our fault. We're not really actors. We're not really human beings. We're not really rational or free people at all. The concept is ultimately that this universe has to be ethnic. It has to be a world of concepts that is mutually understandable by everyone in it. The more foreign elements you bring into it, the less meaning exists. The situation, we know this in Europe, in America, is to bring in as many foreigners as possible. This is now clearly an official idea. Up until recently, you couldn't say this as official policy. Now it's absolutely official policy. The ruling class is bringing in as many completely foreign elements as possible. You're not talking about immigrants here. You're talking about absolute aliens. You know, people who have absolutely no place in society. The cultures are so different from each other. The languages are so different from each other. But that's the point. The purpose is to destroy. Why? Because this universe of shared meanings, and Heidegger in 1933 is referring to as the nation, as the ethnic idea. That's what his design really is, and it's at its best. But that is the only ground for civic life, for discussion, and for rebellion. If you don't have that fundamental background, that fundamental agreement that every debate has to have, any two people debating have to agree on everything else. Because, I mean, you're using words, you're using arguments and logic, you're appealing to an entire world of shared meanings that we often take for granted. But if that universe isn't there, you can't even talk to the person. There's no discussion at all. The only thing either is to simply ignore each other if humanly possible, or to kill each other. You have a chaotic situation where there is no community, there is no possibility of communication. And it's not an accident that community and communication and communion, these all have the same root. Then the most cohesive group, no matter how small, will always dominate. And this ruling class, disproportionately Jewish, but there's certainly other elements as well. And the Jews, of course, always speaking a completely different language, in literal sense and a figurative sense, have always benefited from this kind of social breakdown. They are the only ones who are cohesive and have a strong identity, where everyone else is reaping the pathological rewards of this intense alienation, the pathologies that unfortunately we all know. They benefit. They then rule without any possibility of concerted rebellion. To have a concerted rebellion, you have to have a foundation for the concert. Concert, working together. Well, what is that based on? This has been the problem with Marxism and anarchism for a very long time, and it has never been answered. Otto Bauer, I guess, was one of the few. He deserves a show in his own right, attempting to merge those two things, nationalism and Marxism. But you can't build a society on a negation. Whether it be Marx, or Engels, or Lenin, or Trotsky, it was nothing but a negation. Society was allegedly built on this notion that capitalism, the way they defined it, very odd way that they defined it, was the root of evil, it's exploitative, and then workers, again, defined in a very odd way, need to overthrow it with violence and install a regime that will rule in the interests of that class. Nothing further than that is ever mentioned. Karl Marx, for all of his writings, never talks about what the future society is going to be like. It's all negative. So what does that mean? It generally means that there is a secret agenda. You have an entire political movement with millions of people and millions of dollars and brilliant theoreticians over the course of a long period of time and have absolutely no sense of the future. That doesn't make any sense. It's because we're talking about the creation of chaos. The purpose of creating chaos, suggestibility, the destruction of all institutions, and the maintenance of this constant chaos. This is what Trotsky means by permanent revolution. Without constant chaos, there's always a threat to the Jewish ruling class in the Soviet Union or anywhere else that the Goyim might realize that they have a lot in common and they are losing a lot. There is no future in any of the socialist theories. None of them. For all of their writings, they never talk about what is this going to be. They, in the most vague general sense, they'll talk about a worker being able to be the jack of all trades, you know, to work. Lenin says the final stage will be when all production is absolutely voluntary. And pretty much anyone can do anything. We all have all the skills necessary to work in different fields at the same time. Very, very vague, very kind of stupid. The throwaway lines. It's very suspicious that this whole theory, millions of pages of writing, never mentions what the future is going to be like. Every other political group in the world will go on and on and on about when we take power, everything's going to be wonderful. And they'll give a laundry list of what's going to happen. And often it's very specific. Everyone except Marxism and Leninism. They never talk about it. The entire thing is based entirely on negation, and it has always been. You talk about Marxism today, they only talk in negative terms. They'll talk about capitalism, but never talk about their own future agenda. And if you bring up the Soviet Union or North Korea or anything like that, they'll simply say, that's not really socialism. Which, by the way, you shouldn't let them get away with. That's a completely arbitrary way of thinking. Well, that's not really socialism. Well, it's okay, then our situation here isn't really capitalism. If it's that easy to do. They can arbitrarily say, well, it didn't work out, therefore, because my system is right just a priori, it must not be it. It must be something else. We don't know what that something else is, except in these vague terms. Don't let them get away with that. If they can do that with socialism, you could do that with capitalism or anything else. Well, this isn't really capitalism then. So you have no grounds to complain. But a very suspicious idea. The idea being, of course, is that their agenda was something very different, something they would never tell people. It had to have been a secretive concept. Remember, Karl Marx, the First International, got enraged when Bakunin and the followers of Proudhon and others talked about the fact that maybe workers, actual workers, should be in charge of some of this movement. Karl Marx flew off the handle. I'm telling you, this movement had nothing to do with labor, ever. They may use the word, they may even talk about the theory of value and everything else. They're not talking about workers in the normal sense of the term. They're talking about the party, they're talking about the Jewish elites, they're talking about, you know, this future oligarchy. They're not talking about workers in the normal sense. They're not talking about plumbers and farmers. For the most part, they were held in contempt. The proof of that, of course, in the First International and these other groups, the anarchists, they're thrown out, they're kicked out with an extreme prejudice. And Karl Marx was fuming, almost to the point where people, you know, he's going to have a stroke. The descriptions of his ranting and raving and pacing back and forth at the notion that workers should have some say in how the worker state and how this worker's ideology is going to develop. The movement had nothing to do ever at any point with labor. So what's the point of all this? What Heidegger's talking about, what we're talking about in terms of ethnic nationalism, is a living, breathing culture. It might be dying. It might be very, very sick. Most people may be completely ignorant of it because of bad education and awful surroundings. But we know what that culture is. We know what Christian culture is in depth. We know what German culture is in depth. We can go on and on about it. We can talk about every little family artifact. Socialism can't do that. Socialism refuses to do that. Therefore, the only thing that I can conclude is that socialism in the Marxist and Leninist sense was not about labor. It was all about negations to remove one ruling class so that another ruling class can come into existence. That new ruling class could only exist if there is constant warfare. Heidegger spends a lot of time saying that the distinctions between the world, being, the world of objects, our own personal identity, the community as a whole, that these aren't really separate things. They're separate things in our minds, they're separate things because of our alienation, but not in reality. And you read about Heidegger in contemporary philosophical textbooks, they won't talk about what his solution was. Just like they'll never talk about in public what Marx or Lenin wanted in the future. Heidegger makes it very clear here. He's talking about the ethnic good. A good act is an integral act. George Sorel says the same thing. Integrity, where all faculties, our will, our feelings, our reason, as well as the external world, this ethnic universe that we're born and raised, linguistic world that we're born and raised in, they all are synthesized together, and the act that produces is the good one. That's the one aimed at the common good. That's the rational act. George Sorel is extremely concerned with this idea that capitalism, capital in general, doesn't see being, it doesn't understand being. It only sees individual objects that it creates and that it dominates. The ultimate concept here is, in Trotsky's mind, chaos is absolutely necessary for everyone but them. Now, I talk about this at length because really what I'm dealing with here is the philosophical background of the early Soviet Union. For one thing, remember, civil war in the USSR pretty much never ended until World War II. Stalin admitted that himself. In Kazakhstan, 1930, there were 80 armed guerrilla groups functioning against the state. There were constant, there was constant civil unrest. There was low-level shooting wars, guerrilla wars, all over that empire. The Soviet press, of course, wouldn't talk about it. The American press wouldn't talk about it. There's a book out by Ludmilla Stern. It's called Western Intellectuals and the USSR. And this is something that has confirmed a lot of what I've been preaching for a very long time, that the West at no point was anti-communist. In fact, its ruling class was overwhelmingly in favor of it in a theoretical sense. But this was the wave of the future. It didn't mean that workers were going to take over. That was never meant that in the first place. When I mentioned Karl Marx losing it at the First International, the punchline of all of that is that Bakunin wrote afterwards, he said it's because Karl Marx was getting checks from the Rothschild dynasty. Bakunin goes on and on about how this was a Jewish ethnic movement now, that labor was totally irrelevant to it, in fact held in utter contempt, that labor meant the party and party elites and Jewish elites. That's what labor meant in Karl Marx. And Bakunin was one of the first people to expose, he was one of the leaders of the anarchists, to expose Karl Marx and this whole movement as fraudulent. Ludmilla Stern writes, and this is a fairly recent book, Western intellectuals, I'm not talking about necessarily government, but the ruling class as the most famous writers, intellectuals at the time. In France, they saw the Russian Revolution, and it was depicted in all of the most conservative newspapers as a continuation of the French Revolution. It was glorified beyond belief as continuing the spirit of 1789. That people like Shaw and Webb, Sinclair, the major writers of the era, would ostracize any leftist who criticized the Soviet Union. There was a tremendous amount of money coming in through various institutions, as she writes about in at length, that were established by the Soviets and universities in Western Europe. There was a tremendous amount of contact at that level. The Soviets were very talented at making these connections between intellectuals and writers and the Soviet idea, not necessarily governments or a military apparatus. Walter Duranty is a very famous one, and one of the things that he did, other than simply denying the whole concept of the Holocaust in Ukraine, he said continuously that collectivization wasn't really collectivization. The state had nothing to do with it. It was a spontaneous socialization of production. That's what he was claiming. He also claimed consistently in his career before he got into trouble was that to be anti-Soviet was to be anti-Semitic. And he said this over and over again without ever really explaining this. Of course, he's not going to say that this is a Jewish ethnic movement, but he's implying it all the time. In fact, it's very common at the time in French and German and in English that opposing the Soviet Union always had anti-Semitic overtones. And of course, the question is that how would that be? If it's not a Jewish ethnic movement, why would that even come up? And this is one of the reasons that Walter Duranty was so obsessed with covering over the crimes of Stalin. In terms of ideology, in terms of their views of the party, their views of the army, their views of secret police and everything else, Lenin, Trotsky, and Stalin didn't differ in any respect. They differed in absolutely no respect. Western intellectuals, this group of characters, created this fantasy world, very easily refuted just by reading these people in English, that Trotsky was this humanitarian. Stalin was a monster because, of course, he was anti-Semitic in their minds. And Lenin, of course, was the ultimate in the Enlightenment progress. George Sorel says progress is the ultimate justification for exploitation. And it's no different in the Soviet Union than it is elsewhere. So we began talking about Heidegger. We began talking about the idea that he really did have a future in mind. It wasn't just abstract theorizing about being and objects versus this fluid integral whole that we don't really have access to, that Kant keeps us from. That was a big part of it. But there has to be a payoff for this stuff. Abstract theorizing doesn't come out of nowhere. abstract theorizing has to have a payoff. It has to be, we have to, you know, have some real social or scientific reasons to even care about this stuff. And he says very clearly that this community that we're thrown into is ethnic. It's an ethnic community based on language. Now, the problem that we have dealing with the Soviet Union is that you had a very alien group taking over what was, up until that point, a fairly healthy society. I've proven that over and over again throughout my whole career. So they needed mass warfare. They needed World War I, certainly. They needed the continuation of the Civil War. And after the Civil War, they needed constant fighting. They needed purges, Trotsky didn't like how it turned out, but that kind of mentality was absolutely necessary. War communism in the West, these Western intellectuals were saying that any kind of repression that they would admit, which is very little, but the repression that existed was there because of anti-communist elements in Russia. In other words, enough Christians hadn't been killed. The opposition has to be smashed, which is really what they mean. What they said in public was that because there's so many counter-revolutionary elements there among the clergy, and they used all these slogans, the Black Hundred, they had all these mythical images of who these people were, that war communism and this kind of dictatorship, and this will go away very, very soon. The only reason it exists is because these people haven't been stamped out yet. And again, in that respect, they are they're very much in line with 1789. The connection between the Soviet Union and Heidegger's idea is that the Soviet leadership, Trotsky especially, had to finally reveal to the world what their future endpoint is. They had kept it secret for a long time. Oleg Platonov has given us a tremendous glimpse into the mentality. And the first 10, 15 years of the Soviet Union hasn't been fully understood in English. Platonov has done so, unfortunately only in Russian. And he talks about the arcane nature of a lot of these things. I've mentioned the hammer and sickle. These both were extremely arcane elements. These are elements that only the initiated understood. The sickle is the crescent moon. It is this separation. It is the harvest. This is the harvest of the Enlightenment, the final revenge of the Jews against Gentiles, as we see during the execution of Tsar Nicholas. The hammer is to be understood primarily as they look at the Gentiles, look at Gentile society as this very rough chunk of stone. The hammer is to smash it into shape, to bring it into the shape necessary to create Adam Kadmon by the use of force and violence and revolution. That's the hammer and the sickle. To believe that the sickle had anything to do with the peasantry is ridiculous. They loathe the peasantry. The working class had nothing to do with Marxism, as he proved in the First International. So the meaning for these things has to be looked at elsewhere. But Trotsky is forced to reveal to the world what this was. The Soviet calendar was completely rewritten. There were 72 five-day weeks. Sunday was removed from the calendar entirely. It was the exact same calendar, according to Platonov, that existed in Egypt at the monumental period of the pyramids of Giza. 360 days, and there were five holidays at the end of the year. It was completely rationalized and completely standardized. Trotsky and Stalin used the word, especially Trotsky more than anybody else, used the word kulak, the Russian for fist. And it's a term that deserves more study. The common understanding is that this refers to peasants that had more money than the rest. Officially, it meant any peasant that could hire a laborer, one laborer, for more than 2 or 3 months out of the year. In practice, it had no meaning whatsoever. But I wanted to get deeper into the nature of this word. Why this word? It had been around before. It had been used before. But Trotsky had absolutely no connection or association with any peasant society at all. Kulak had been a word used for moneylenders for a long time, often Gentile moneylenders in this case. It was for not just rich peasants, but peasants who then adopted the mentality of their masters and began lending money and interest, things like that. They were, commune destroyers. But this isn't what Trotsky meant. And this is the same Trotsky who believed that Jacob Schiff is a proletarian. You know, this is how these words were defined. They had no connection. They used labor, and we think of some guy in a factory. That's mythology. Most of the guys in the factories they hated. Jacob Schiff was a proletarian, a poor priest in Ukraine, and loyal peasants around him were capitalist exploiters. You can't exactly take these people at their word. One of the more recent definitions of the term kulak is in certain engines. The technology was just developing at the time. Of course, the Soviets were very up on this. It was when cyclical motion becomes linear motion. And the word is used, it's not defined that way very often. But the notion of this, the kulak in that sense, is when the cyclical life of the peasantry, based around the church calendar and the seasons, the renewal, decay, renewal, this mentality that all agrarians have, is replaced by a mechanism, a machinery, electricity. It is thrust onto the linear view of history. It's even sometimes used for the camshaft. It's to move the direction of something in an engine. To take something in other words, to take the force of something like an explosion of a mixture of air and gasoline to create the explosion, which creates the force. But it takes that force and directs it. It directs it outward. It directs it into a very specific motion. So the arcane definition of kulak was the transference of the cyclical mentality of the peasant into the linear mode of the Enlightenment concept of progress. The Second Civil War, the Civil War between the Reds and the Whites ends in roughly 1921, but there's the Second Civil War, 1928 to 1933, that was waged against collectivism. This was a liquidation of the peasantry in key parts of the empire. They were being fed routinely by the United States and Canada. Food was not a problem. In fact, there was never a time when the USSR was self-sufficient in food. Tsarist Russia always was and was feeding the planet. That was not a concern. They knew that they had enough connections abroad that they were always would be fed. That was never the problem. Woodrow Wilson himself took care of that early on. Now, the Second Civil War was a very intense warfare, with the shooting war, as well as other less conventional forms of warfare against collectivization. The understanding that this definition of kulak is exactly what was going on, that the world that had maintained Russia for many centuries, that was hated, not really understood, but hated by this new Jewish communist class, had to be completely changed from its cyclical mentality to its forward thrust, the Enlightenment concept of linear progress. Well, because this term is used for internal combustion engines, again, something that the early Bolsheviks were very interested in developing and bringing to the Soviet Union, which had existed under Tsarism but was destroyed by the time they took power. So they were very interested in this sense of the term. This was not an oddity to them, maybe an oddity to us. But this very more eccentric definition of kulak is at the time, was normal for them. But it was very arcane, even to the average Russian at the time. It needed to be the explosion, that violence is revolution. So the force of the revolution the force of the hammer against this unfinished stone, this hunk of nothing, which is how they viewed the peasantry, how they viewed the Gentile, needed to be directed and thrust outward. And the party, this was their job. The future notion of the Soviet idea, of the Marxist idea, was revealed in Trotsky and in Stalin by simply oligarchy. Because the absolute rapacious domination of a ruling class, united really in their Judaism, even if they were secular people, it doesn't matter. Judaism is certainly, you know, not much of a religion. It's mostly an ethnic identification. While everybody else got the new Egyptian calendar. The culture is destroyed. The family is destroyed. The commune is destroyed. The economy becomes extremely irrational. In exchange, the ruling class is able to take whatever it wants. The wars, the guerrilla wars that were going on in Russia were continuous, right up until the German invasion. But they were always able to be crushed, not just by force of arms, but also by media silence, both in Russia and abroad. And really, Platonov, as far as I know, is the only man who's ever really doing any research into this. There's a few others. But there is a constant, an entire guerrilla movement that's almost completely unknown even in Russia between the death of Lenin in 1925 and Hitler's invasion. Stalin himself admitted that that war never ended. The initial force that was used against the counter-revolution was Cheka, an acronym for the anti-counter-revolutionary armed corps. It was irregular in the sense they really had no law to follow, they had no procedure to follow, they were simply to crush by any means necessary. Only when this Jewish ruling class was more or less firmly ensconced in power was then the AGPU created. Only when that occurred was a more regularized kind of police force able to come into existence. But they didn't need to worry. I mean, Czechoslovakia and France, Germany, these all had free trade agreements with the Soviet Union. It doesn't make any difference whether, you know, it was recognized or not. That's completely irrelevant. The dollar doesn't know whether the Soviet Union is officially recognized or not. But trade with the Soviet Union in Lenin and Stalin's era up until the outbreak of the war was vigorous. You know, the 788 factories built between 1926 and 1927, every one of which was founded by an American company just for that particular year. Now, you take, for example, Francisco Franco in Spain. I mean, here we have, and I've proven this over and over again, the Western love affair. Financial, I mean, they were, as America's drowning in the Depression, they are sending millions to the Soviet Union to build the new paradise. 1946, France closes its borders to Franco-Spain. There was a full UN boycott of the Spanish economy. The American plan was for Spain to be a full-fledged democracy, except all royalist parties would be banned. Yet in July of 1947, a referendum was passed. Spain declared itself for monarchy, and a Christian monarchy. Of 17 million votes that were cast, 14 million were in favor. You contrast that in 1929, the Red Army was permitted a grand tour of American defense plants. It was taught the basics of developing the foundation of a defense industry, and bought most of its new equipment there directly. So there's simply no way to deny that the Western world was pro-Soviet, created the Soviets, an anti-communist, effective anti-communist, whether it be in South Africa or in Madrid, were treated with utter contempt. But to maintain this narrative that the West is somehow anti-communist, and that they were even really different from one another, they have to pretend that Spain was seen as some sort of an ally. This is absolute nonsense. He started off by talking about Martin Heidegger, and that very easily lent itself to the idea that the kind of abstract theorizing that you read, whether it be in his own work or in Karl Marx, always has to have a payoff. The problem is, Soviet and Marxist thinking, there never is that payoff. It's nothing but negation. This is extremely important for the entire movement over a long period of time. Trotsky, unfortunately, for them, had to reveal it. And this is why it was so extremely important the Soviet Union control the press, that was able to control the intellectual mentality. This was far more important than free trade agreements. They weren't worried about that. They knew they were always going to be bailed out, that there was always going to be more surplus value to extract from workers. That was never the issue. It was more important for them to capture the minds of the Western world, to have this notion that there is this capitalist communist war out there, other than being two sides of the same coin. That somehow socialism and equality has something to do with destroying the church. It's always kind of stood out like a sore thumb. What would one have to do with the other? But it has something to do with it only because this was a Jewish ethnic movement. This was a nationalist movement of overwhelmingly secular Jews. Once this old vocabulary of this war between the West and the East, between capitalism and communism, and that could or not, once that nonsense is jettisoned, then reality starts to sink in. You compare how Putin as a nationalist is being treated today versus how in the Soviet Union free trade was perfectly normal and trade and profits were made on both sides. Now there are sanctions on Putin's Russia, which, by the way, is probably the best thing that ever happened to him. He's in the process of taking over the central bank. He is finished with the Rothschilds. He's made that very, very clear. And from what I understand, there's an arrest warrant for George Soros. You dare step foot on Russian territory, there's going to be an international incident of some importance. When you consider Francisco Franco, that's just another example. I was thinking of about how the West absolutely went crazy here. And yet Stalin received investment, diplomatic support, military equipment, propaganda, making him look like the most wonderful man alive. Uncle Joe having a two judges at Nuremberg passing judgment on Germans. This was a freedom-loving new French revolutionaries in Russia kind of idea that the French press was promoting for a long time. This is what Stalin was. Only recently do you have a different point of view. The Russian emigres were absolutely useless. There are a lot of smart people in the emigration, Russian exiles on the right wing, but very few of them learned English. They were extremely cultish. They were very suspicious of outsiders because they knew infiltration was a very real possibility. So they ended up being very ineffective. And this was understood. The Soviet Union, these were masters of propaganda, but the old royalist idea that propaganda is vulgar. It is. It's about lying. It's about manipulation. Monarchy is about the truth. It's about natural law. They would never stoop to something as vulgar as propaganda, and yet they suffered as a result of refusing to do that. The future, the reality that what Marxism was the development of a Jewish, in the Soviet Union, in Eastern Europe, a Jewish ruling clique, the purpose of which was to extract as much surplus value as humanly possible from labor and peasantry, and to destroy their opposition, create a pure oligarchy, to make an oligarchy as pure as possible. It wasn't purely ethnic. The old Bolsheviks were purged. They were never purged because they were Jews, but because Jewish dominance in the early Soviet Union was so overwhelming that any attack on the old Bolsheviks is going to be an attack on Jews. But this is how, again, proving the point, the only way that Stalin was made unpalatable was to make him an anti-Semite. And so this whole myth that Stalin was attacking Jews and purging the Jews as such is absolute garbage. I mentioned this in this show before. But it was necessary also to deny the idea that this was an ethnic movement. The very fact that in purging the old Bolsheviks, almost every single major person in those early purges were Jewish, is demonstration that this was an ethnic movement in the early years of the Soviet Union. That any purge of the old Bolsheviks is going to have a whole lot of Jews in it. Very easy to portray that in the West as an anti-Jewish movement. But only then could Stalin be portrayed as someone who the left is safe to hate. He was portrayed as a nationalist and an anti-Semite, and therefore it was signaled to the left that they could dislike him. It's okay to dislike him now. The conclusion to all this, that in Heidegger, we see that his concern with being, with history, how we conceptualize the world, has the payoff in the ethnic community. That this is the common good. This could be the only ground possible for the common good. Because only there do you have a self-contained, autarkic cultural unit with its own language and definitive ways of being. But just like our own individuality is never perfectly integrated, the nation is never perfectly integrated either. There's always rough edges. But certainly the essence is there and very easy to describe. This is left out of concepts talking about Heidegger because it shows him as National Socialism as humane in this case. He wasn't much of a Hitlerian. He was a National Socialist, though. The way to rebuild was to remember who Germans were and how the entire world, the language, the ways of thinking and acting aren't new. They have taken many centuries to develop and are specifically German. That's the common good. That's the foundation for any integral action at all. So his notion of what this, the payoff all of, for this existential idea, for his rejection of conformism or egocentrism, the two sides of the pathological coin, this is the common good. Marxism, you don't see it. They will not talk about what the future was supposed to be, but you saw it with Trotsky. And the Soviet Union was absolutely brilliant in how it was able to manipulate the West to control information, where you had low-level civil wars consistently from 1918 to 1941. And then when Germans invaded, you had, there were 800,000 Slavs fighting in the German army at the time. 1938, a full 20% of the Red Army had already deserted. No one was interested in this because after a while, the party dominated the army to such an extent that ideological conformity was far more important than combat readiness. And it's very obvious to see the distinction here. You take Putin today, Franco, South Africa 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, I should say, and then the Soviet Union, where Woodrow Wilson and the Carnegie family was sending millions and millions of dollars via Elihu Root in order to bail them out of any problems and to make sure that they are solidified in power and can be used to check the Germans. You see two very, very different approaches to the world. You see one that is based on occultism, initiation, the arcana, double-mindedness, lies, propaganda, manipulation, which the Soviet and Marxist model always was. On the other hand, you had a clear, philosophically defensible manifestation of nationalism with Martin Heidegger. And so when you read him, or even people like Frank, any of the other intuitivists understand that this abstract theorizing exists to ground an actual practical idea, and that is, what is the common good? What is the common in that phrase? And how do we know it? And how is it different from everybody else? And then what the good is already sunk into what the nature of the common is. And that's the difference between the two ways of thinking. So I know this has been a bit more abstract than normal, but that's been my tradition really up until fairly recently. For those who are you're reading these people, I'm available to assist at any time. But always remember that you don't get into this level of metaphysics unless there's some payoff. And if they don't tell you what it is, then there's a problem. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to
The Orthodox Nationalist
with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson and RadioArian.com.